In the world of crime novels, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the characters who commit and solve the crimes, and the authors who write about them. These are their stories.
Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles, and if you listen closely, you can almost hear an iconic theme playing in the background. Yes, that's it. This week, our literary lineup is all about Law and Order. I've been casing the bestseller lists, and they are teeming with cop and legal thrillers. Investigators, lawyers, detectives, district attorneys. Yup, if you've got the time, I bet you're reading crime. Or at least thinking about the next suspect on your reading list. So I'm on it. Here goes. Let's turn to page one of the book report. In his new title, Sycamore Row, John Grisham returns to the courthouse he made famous in A Time to Kill. Jake Briggins once again finds himself embroiled in a fiercely controversial trial, a trial that will expose old racial tensions and force Ford County to confront its tortured history. Seth Hubbard is a wealthy man dying of lung cancer. He trusts no one. Before he hangs himself from a sycamore tree, Hubbard leaves a new handwritten will. It's an act that will drag his children, his maid, and Jake into a conflict as dramatic as the murder trial that made Briggins one of Ford County's most notorious citizens 3 years earlier. Why would Hubbard leave nearly all his fortune to his maid? Had chemotherapy affected his ability to think? And what does it all have to do with a piece of land once known as Sycamore Row? The New York Times Book Review had this to say about the book. John Grisham is about as good a storyteller as we've got. We'd have to say the verdict is in. Michael Beck narrates.
The logistics of hanging oneself from a tree are not that simple. Evidently, Seth thought of everything. The rope was 3/4-inch braided natural manila of some age and easily strong enough to handle Seth, who weighed 160 pounds a month earlier at the doctor's office. Later, an employee in one of Seth's factories would report that he had seen his boss cut the 50-foot length from a spool a week before using it in such dramatic fashion. One end was tied firmly to a lower branch of the same tree and secured with a slapdash mix of knots and lashings. But they held. The other end was looped over a higher branch, 2 feet in girth, and exactly 21 feet from the ground. From there it fell about 9 feet, culminating in a perfect hangman's knot, one that Seth had undoubtedly worked on for some time. The noose was straight from the textbook, with 13 coils designed to collapse the loop under pressure. A true hangman's knot snaps the neck, making death quicker and less painful, and apparently Seth had done his homework. Other than what was obvious, there was no sign of a struggle or suffering. A 6-foot stepladder had been kicked aside and was lying benignly nearby. Seth had picked his tree, flung his rope, tied it off, climbed the ladder, adjusted the noose, and when everything was just right, kicked the ladder and fell. His hands were free and dangling near his pockets. Had there been an instant of doubt, of second-guessing, when his feet left the safety of the ladder, but with his hands still free, had Seth instinctively grabbed the rope above his head and fought desperately until he surrendered? No one would ever know. But it looked doubtful. Later evidence would reveal that Seth had been a man on a mission. For the occasion, he had selected his finest suit, a thick wool blend, dark gray, and usually reserved for funerals in cooler weather. He owned only 3. A proper hanging has the effect of stretching the body so Seth's trouser cuffs stopped at his ankles and his jacket stopped at his waist. His black wingtips were polished and spotless. His blue necktie was perfectly knotted. His white shirt, though, was stained with blood that had oozed from under the rope. Within hours, it would be known that Seth Hubbard had attended the 11 a.m. worship service at a nearby church. He had spoken to acquaintances, joked with a deacon, placed an offering in the plate, and seemed in reasonably good spirits. Most folks knew Seth was battling lung cancer, though virtually no one knew the doctors had given him a short time to live. Seth was on several prayer lists at the church. However, he carried the stigma of two divorces and would always be tainted as a true Christian. His suicide would not help matters. The tree was an ancient sycamore Seth and his family had owned for many years. The land around it was thick with hardwoods, valuable timber Seth had mortgaged repeatedly and parlayed into wealth. His father had acquired the land by dubious means back in the 1930s. Both of Seth's ex-wives had tried valiantly to take the land in the divorce wars, but he held on. They got virtually everything else. First on the scene was Calvin Boggs, a handyman and farm laborer Seth had employed for several years. Early Sunday morning, Calvin had received a call from his boss. "Meet me at the bridge at 2 p.m., Seth said. He didn't explain anything, and Calvin was not one to ask questions. If Mr. Hubbard said to meet him somewhere at a certain time, then he would be there. At the last minute, Calvin's 10-year-old boy begged to tag along, and against his instincts, Calvin said yes.
We've just heard Sycamore Row by John Grisham. Allison Liotta served as a federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. for 12 years. She focused on sex crimes, domestic violence, and crimes against children. Allison draws on those years to create some of the most compelling legal thrillers on the market today. In fact, she's been dubbed the female John Grisham. Allison is a weekly contributor to the Huffington Post, where she reality checks TV crime dramas. For the last 3 years, her blog, The Primetime Crime Review, has been cited as one of the best legal blogs in America by the American Bar Association. Allison graduated from Michigan State University and Harvard Law. She lives outside of Washington. Today, we'll speak with her about her third book, Speak of the Devil. Welcome, Allison. It's a pleasure to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine. The pleasure is mine.
Allison, you take readers on a wild ride right from the get-go. Your main character, Anna Curtis, receives a wedding proposal, and she's called to work on a gruesome gang murder right at the beginning of the book. Fabulous opening.
Thank you.
Is MS-13 based on an actual Salvadoran gang?
Yes, it is a real gang. They're really called MS-13. And National Geographic calls them the world's most dangerous gang. I really wanted to put Anna in danger in this book and have her face a real sort of physical threat. And as a prosecutor, I think there are very few cases that are as dangerous to try, to take to trial, as those involving this particular gang.
Wow. What does Mara Salvatruca mean?
It means, loosely translated, it means look out for us Salvadoran gangsters.
So are there pods in each and every city where there's a large Hispanic population in the U.S.?
There are. It has gone viral. It started off as this kind of small band of thugs in L.A. in the 1990s as a result of all the immigrants from the Civil War in El Salvador. And since then, it has just gone viral. They estimate there are 50,000 members worldwide, and there are cliques or pods in every major American city. And the violence that they bring is really remarkable. They're different from other gangs that way. Other gangs usually have a kind of a reason. They want to control the drugs in the market or the guns, or they want to control a particular territory. But for MS-13, the violence is the point. They've made a name for themselves just by being the craziest, most brutal group of people out there. And that makes them particularly dangerous and fearsome.
For the gang initiation, the jumped in, there is the 13-second beating.
Right. That's for the boys.
For the boys. And yeah, and then you write about a sexing in ritual for the girls. And honestly, in my mind, the 13-second beating seems way more bearable than the sexing in.
I agree. And that's part of what, you know, I wanted to talk about in the gang is it's not just brutal. It's brutally misogynistic. the way that they treat women, both the girls in their gang and women outside of their gang, is so incredibly medieval. It's amazing. And, right, I think it's very well encapsulated in that initiation ritual where the boys are beaten in for 13 seconds, but the girls are sexed in. They have to have sex with every boy in the gang. And it's a ritual, I think, that's purposely intended to humiliate the girl, to make her feel like she is the property of every boy in the gang, and really to give the boys, and these are boys who very often are at the bottom of society's food chain and really do feel that, but it's intended to give them a sense that at least they have power in one place in the world, and that is over the girls.
Right. And to quote you, you wrote, "These were the boys at the bottom of society's food chain. The world taunted them with their low status, their inferiority, with all the things they would never own or achieve. But at least they were superior to the girls. Here they had power."
Right. And I think that's what sexual assault so often comes down to. It's very, you know, sometimes it's about physical urges, lust, pleasure, but so often it's about power.
Do the gangs coordinate kind of city to city?
You know, it's an interesting structure. They each have these local cliques, so they wreak their own havoc in their own cities. But there's also kind of an overarching leadership that's kind of vague and cloudy. And some of it is based in El Salvador, and some of it is just kind of in the wind. And that's kind of what I tried to portray with the leader, Diablo. The Diablo is based on a real leader of the MS-13 gang that really was going up and down the coasts of America and trying to rile up the gang. There was this feeling that some of the cliques were not being brutal enough. They were just kind of sitting around smoking weed or watching TV, and that wasn't good enough. So this particular leader went around, and he was like a one-man crime wave in every city, forcing them to commit more murders and robberies, prostitution, extortion, rapes, and so that's the character of Diablo in Speak of the Devil.
I know that many boys don't live to grow out of the gang, but do men actually age out of being in the gang?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because they recruit these young kids. They recruit kids at the age of 13, 14 years old, and it's very well known that once you're in the gang, you're in for life. But when you're 13 or 14, I don't think you really know what for life means. I don't think you see it that way. And what you do see are these 20-year-old young men, and at 20, you're kind of an old man in the gang at that point, and they want to leave. They want to, you know, just go on and have a regular life, and they can't. They're stuck in this middle ground of being too good to want to do what the gang makes them do anymore, but too bad to really return to regular life. And also not being permitted to leave. They'll be killed first. Their family will be killed if they leave the gang. And I've certainly felt a measure of sympathy for men, evil as they are, and the bad things that they've done in that situation, who have no path out, no real path to redemption.
And this is a very good segue to your mystery man in the novel, who Hector Ramos. Talk about him a bit.
Yes. Well, Hector Ramos is a cop with a very shadowy sort of background. I don't want to give away too much, but he was a very interesting character to write in terms of finding someone who has tried to find a way to redeem himself and who carries secrets just despite all of his best intentions.
Mm. Well, I've often wondered, you served 12 years as a prosecutor of truly heinous crimes. Was it possible for you to close the office door, return home as an ordinary wife and mom with, you know, a sunny suburban outlook?
Well, I tried. I think I'm definitely much more cautious as a mom than maybe most moms are, given the stories that I've heard and the cases that I tried. I think there's no way to do that job for the length of time that I did it and not have it affect you in that way. But I do try very consciously not to be a helicopter mom and to make my kids feel like the world is generally a safe place.
Well, tell us about the Primetime Crime Review.
Well, that is my blog. I also blog for the Huffington Post, and I look at TV crime dramas and I evaluate what they're getting right and wrong from my perspective as a former prosecutor.
All right, which TV show gets it closest to right?
Well, I think The Wire did. I think The Wire was just brilliant, and I've actually heard that thugs in Baltimore, where the show is set, used to watch the show to figure out what methods of police surveillance were being used to track it down in real life, because they were just getting it all so right. But then on the other side of the equation is CSI, which every prosecutor you've ever spoken to will hate because of the CSI effect, where jurors come in expecting this magical science in each and every case, and it's just not at all the reality, and prosecutors have to align reality with their CSI-based expectations.
I hope you give Hawaii Five-O a good score, because I just think that McGarrett is the hottest-looking guy.
That does count for a lot.
Okay. Well, what's next for you? Are you already at work on your next thriller?
I am. Simon & Schuster signed me up for two more, so I'm working on the fourth book in the Anna Curtis series, and I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be an interesting and different one.
Well, I have to tell you, once you grab your readers from page one, they don't want to put down the book, myself included. Well, Allison, I loved Speak of the Devil, and it was great fun to talk to you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
All righty, bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's hear a sampling of Speak of the Devil, performed by Tavia Gilbert.
Anna watched the restaurant's inner door swing open, and Jack strode into the Tabard Inn's courtyard. Broad-shouldered, a couple inches north of 6 feet tall, Jack always made an impression when he walked into a room. He had smooth brown skin and light green eyes, and wore his head cleanly shaved. Tonight, he'd traded his usual suit for dark jeans and a white linen button-down shirt, allowing her a glimpse of the dark copper skin of his chest. He walked with easy grace across the brick patio to her. She noticed some other diners, mostly women, but a few men, watching him. Anna stood nervously, causing her napkin to fall off her lap. She leaned to pick it up. When she stood again, Jack was next to her. She tipped her head up to meet his eyes, wondering what kind of reception she would find there. He smiled at her warily, but with real warmth, and her heart did a happy little dance. "Hello, Anna." His voice was a deep baritone, incredibly sexy when it was this soft. "Hi." Being this close to him made her feel a little shaky, in the best way. They paused, unsure how to greet each other after all this time. She closed the space between them, put her hand on his bicep, and leaned up to kiss his cheek. It was freshly shaved smooth, but his scent was what really got to her. Soap, clean linen, and the fresh peppermint that his daughter put in his pocket every morning. He was the one who pulled her the final few inches into a hug. She rested her forehead against his jawbone, closed her eyes, and let her nose almost graze the side of his neck as she breathed him in. "It's good to see you," he murmured. "Yes." When she opened her eyes, much of the conversation on the patio had stopped. People were looking at them. She cleared her throat and stepped back, feigning nonchalance. She was used to the stares. Jack was African-American, born and bred in D.C., street smart with a professorial edge. She was blonde and blue-eyed, slowly learning to tamp down her earnest Midwestern smile. Even in the diverse district, they drew the occasional stare. "You look beautiful," Jack said. "Tall." "You too," she laughed. The 4-inch heels she wore with her little black dress were a departure. Even with the extra height, she was 2 inches shorter than Jack. She felt both glamorous and unsteady. They sat at the round iron table, the candle throwing soft light onto Jack's angular cheekbones. A waiter came and gestured to the wine list. She didn't know wine, so she just chose a bottle of champagne in the middle. It cost more than she'd normally spend on groceries for a week. But what the hell? It might be the biggest night of her life. Jack raised his eyebrows but didn't comment. "Thanks for coming," she said.
"Of course. Your call was unexpected, but welcome."
Welcome was good. Welcome meant she had a chance. During their big fight, Anna had been furious at him. But with the passage of time and the perspective that came with it, she realized that she'd been at least partially wrong.
Okay, mostly wrong.
But that fight was just a symptom of a much larger problem, that Jack had wanted a long-term commitment while she remained uncertain. After they broke up, she was heartsick, but knew it was pointless to rekindle their romance unless she was certain she would stay forever. That was only fair to him and his 6-year-old daughter. Now that Anna was certain, she didn't know if he still felt the same way. The waiter came back with a chilled bottle. He popped the cork and splashed an inch of the bubbly into Anna's flute, then stood looking at her expectantly. It took her a moment to realize she was supposed to taste the champagne. Growing up, it had been a big deal when her mom took them to Denny's. She took a sip and paused, as if making a truly discriminating choice. "Excellent," she pronounced. The waiter bowed slightly and poured champagne into both flutes. Jack was fighting back a smile. He was 10 years older, and it sometimes felt decades wiser. "How are things on the 9th floor? She asked.
"Okay."
Jack was chief of the homicide unit, one of the most prestigious positions in the country's largest U.S. attorney's office.
That was Speak of the Devil by Allison Liotta. In Joe Robertson's The Watcher, forensic psychiatrist Kate Myers believes the killer of 2 teenage girls in Bigler County, California, is the same man who savagely murdered her twin sister nearly 15 years ago. Working on sheer tenacity, she sets out to prove it. Deputy Sheriff Ben Slater hides his personal pain behind the job, but Kate's arrival knocks his world on its axis. He wants to believe her wild theory, but the idea of a serial killer with this pathology is bizarre. Together, they work to find a killer whose roots began in Bigler County, but whose violence is spreading across the country. Soon the killer, more monster than man, fixates on Kate and wants nothing more than to kill her again. Robert Forge narrates.
Catherine Myers' arrival at the Bigler County Sheriff's Office made quite a splash with every man in the bullpen. Detective Slater watched the lithe blonde maintain her composure while his fellow officers stared and gawked. A cold, blustery wind, unusual for California in late October, blew from behind her through the open door and whipped wheat-colored strands of hair across her face. Dressed smartly in a tailored navy suit and white shirt, bare legs long and slim above navy heels, she looked straight ahead as she made her way through the bullpen. Her calf muscles tightened with each stride, and the fingers of one hand gripped the thin brown strap of her purse. The other hand attempted to tug her hair out of her eyes. Slater gave her kudos for ignoring the whole bunch of them and focusing instead on some unseen spot on the opposite wall as she walked straight to Sheriff Marconi's office. Pretty women could be pretty traps, Slater knew from experience, so he turned back to his report and eyed the phone as he waited for Wilson to call him from the coroner's office. Marilyn and Kenneth Johnston had ID'd their daughter's body this afternoon, and Wilson had made the autopsy a priority. Although Slater had looked for signs of something off in the parents, he'd read nothing but horror and grief on their faces. Of course, they'd had nearly a week to practice, and he'd follow up on their alibis. But although Slater sensed tension in the Johnston household, he didn't think it amounted to murder. He and Bauer had finished up at the crime scene around 11 and hightailed it over to the school, where they spoke again to several of the Johnston girls' teachers and friends. Nothing new. Now that he'd finished his report, his curiosity compelled him to keep one eye on the sheriff's closed office door. He drummed his fingers on the desk. Until 5 years ago, the Bigler County Sheriff's Department, housed in Placer Hills, didn't have a computer system. When Slater discovered that even his nieces and nephews used computers at their elementary school, he'd pressured the sheriff into updating their entire system. The old IBMs, purchased at a bargain from the high school district, gave way to new computers. It had only taken 3 years. 15 minutes after the woman entered Marconi's office, the door opened and the sheriff emerged.
"Slater! Bauer! Get in here!"
Slater's partner, Matthew Bauer, rolled his chair back from the desk that faced Slater.
"You suppose the boss wants us to meet her?"
Slater looked up from his report. "Meet who?"
"Are you blind? The looker that just came in. There's not a red-blooded American in the county wouldn't like to see her on his arm. She's the most gorgeous thing I ever saw.
Slater never ceased to be entertained by his partner's old-fashioned expressions. Maybe Marconi needs our help. She might be too much woman for him to handle. Bauer blushed.
Aw, Slater, you hadn't ought to talk about a lady that way.
Who says she's a lady? Let's go find out. Sheriff Xavier M. Marconi had squeezed his enormous bulk behind a walnut desk that matched his size. In spite of the clutter of papers, files, and an ashtray littered with cigarette butts, Slater knew the chief was very organized about his cases. Slater rolled his eyes toward the no-smoking sign posted over the door, the same sign displayed in every public building in the state. He thought the woman suppressed a smile.
Slater, Bauer, this here's Dr. Catherine Myers.
Marconi didn't offer them a seat.
She's come all the way from Los Angeles to help us out around here. Detective Slater's in command of the investigations. Bauer's his partner.
He dragged the city's name out so that the last syllable of Angeles rhymed with fleas. Marconi had lived in Bigler County all his life, had never even visited the big, bad city of the angels. Dr. Myers rose from the wooden chair in front of Marconi's desk, extended her hand first to Bauer, then Slater.
Call me Kate, please.
Her grip was firm and cool as her fingers wrapped around Slater's. Their hands contrasted sharply, his skin the deep brown he'd inherited from his father's side of the family, hers a light tan. Freckles sprinkled her nose. When she spoke, a dimple indented a single spot below her left cheek.
Help us out with what?
Slater asked, looking from the woman to Marconi.
The Jennifer Johnston case, Marconi answered.
Slater narrowed his eyes in suspicion. The murder they'd caught this morning.
That was The Watcher by Joe Robertson. Harry Hole returns, or does he? In a new roller coaster of a thriller by Joe Nesbo, an author recently crowned the king of Scandinavian crime fiction. In Police, Book 10 in the Harry Hole series, the police urgently need Harry. But wait a minute, wasn't he killed in Phantom, Book 9 of the series? The book report thought so. In this title, a killer is stalking Oslo's streets. Police officers are being slain at scenes of crimes they once investigated but failed to solve. The murders are brutal, the media reaction hysterical. For years, Detective Harry Hole had been at the center of every major criminal investigation in Oslo. His dedication to the job and his brilliant insights have saved the lives of countless people. But now, Harry is not in a position to protect anyone. John Lee narrates.
The sun did not want to relinquish the town. It stretched out its fingers like a prolonged farewell through a train window. The day had begun with cold, clear air and sharp beams of light, like lamps in an operating theater. Later, the temperature had risen. The sky had gone a deeper blue, and the air possessed that pleasant physical feel which made September the most wonderful month in the year. And as dusk came, tentative and gentle, the air in the residential quarter on the hills towards Lake Maridal smelt of apples and warm spruce trees. Erlend Venesla was approaching the top of the final hill. He could feel the lactic acid now, but concentrated on getting the correct vertical thrust on the click-in pedals, with his knees pointing slightly inwards, because it was important to have the right technique, especially when you were tired and your brain was telling you to change position so that the onus was on less tired, though less effective, muscles. He could feel how the rigid cycle frame absorbed and used every watt he pedaled into it, how he accelerated when he switched down a gear and stood up, trying to keep the same rhythm, about 90 revolutions a minute. He checked his heart rate monitor, 168. He pointed his headlamp at the sat-nav he had attached to the handlebars. It had a detailed map of Oslo and its surrounds. The bike and the accessories had cost him more than, strictly speaking, a recently retired detective should spend. But it was important to stay in shape, now that life offered different challenges. Fewer challenges, if he was honest. The lactic acid was burning in his thighs and calves now. Painful, but also a wonderful promise of what was to come. an endorphin fest. Tender muscles, good conscience, a beer with his wife on their balcony if the temperature didn't plummet after sunset. And suddenly he was up. The road leveled out, and Lake Maridal was in front of him. He slowed down. He was out of the town. It was absurd, in fact, that after 15 minutes hard cycling from the center of a European capital city, you were surrounded by farms, fields, and dense forest, with paths disappearing into the dusk. The sweat was making his scalp itch beneath the charcoal-gray Bell helmet, which alone had cost the same as the bike he had bought as a 6th birthday present for his granddaughter, Lina Marie. But he kept the helmet on. Most deaths among cyclists were caused by head injuries. He looked at his monitor. 175. 172. A welcome little gust of wind carried the sound of distant cheering up from the town. It must have been from Ullevål Stadium. There was an important international match this evening. Slovakia, or Slovenia. Erland Veneslaw imagined for a few seconds that they had been applauding for him. It was a while since anyone had done that. The last time would have been the farewell ceremony at Kripos, up at Brin. Layer cake, speech by the boss, Mikhail Bellman, who since then had continued his steady rise to take the top police job. And Erland had received the applause, met their eyes, thanked them, and even felt his throat constrict as he was about to deliver his simple, brief speech. Simple, sticking to the facts, as was now the tradition at Kripos. He'd had his ups and downs as a detective, but he had avoided major blunders, at least as far as he knew. Of course, you were never 100% sure you had the right answer. With the rapid advances made in DNA technology, and a signal from the upper echelons that they would use it to examine isolated cold cases, there was a risk of precisely that. Answers. New answers. Conclusions. As long as they concentrated on unsolved cases, that was fine. But Erland didn't understand why they would waste resources on investigations which had long been filed away. The darkness had deepened, and even in the light from the street lamps, he almost cycled past the wooden sign pointing into the forest. But there it was, exactly as he remembered. He turned off and rode on to the soft forest floor. He slowly followed the path without losing his balance. The cone of light from his headlamp shone ahead, and was halted by the thick wall of spruce trees on either side when he turned his head. Shadows flitted in front of him, startled and hurried, changed shape and dived under cover.
That was Police by Joe Nesbo. In a shadowy, crumbling Edinburgh housing development, a junkie lies dead of an overdose. His body surrounded by signs of satanic worship. So begins Ian Rankin's Hide and Seek, book two of the Inspector Rebus series. The inspector could call it an accident, but he won't. Now he's got to search the city from the tunnels of its dark underbelly to the private sanctum of the upper crust to find the perfect hiding place for a killer. Michael Page narrates.
Charlie had a room all right. It consisted of a single sleeping bag, a desk, angle-poise lamp, and more books than Rebus had ever seen in such an enclosed space. They were piled against the walls, reaching in precarious pillars from floor to ceiling. Many were library books, well overdue. "Must owe the city fathers a small fortune," said McCall. There were books on economics, politics, and history, as well as learned and not-so-learned tomes on demonism, devil worship, and witchcraft. There was little fiction, and most of the books had been read thoroughly, with much underlining and penciled marginalia. On the desk sat a half-completed essay, part of Charlie's university coursework, no doubt. It seemed to be trying to link magic to modern society, but was mostly, to Rebus's eye, rambling nonsense. "Hello?" This was shouted from downstairs as the two constables started to climb the staircase. "Hello yourselves," McCall called back. Then he shook the contents of a large supermarket carrier bag onto the floor, so that pens, toy cars, cigarette papers, a wooden egg, a spool of cotton, a personal cassette player, a Swiss Army knife, and a camera fell out. McCall stooped to pick up the camera between thumb and middle finger. Nice model, 35mm SLR. Good make. He gestured with it towards Rebus, who took it from him, having first produced a handkerchief from his pocket with which he held it. Rebus turned towards Tracy, who was standing against the door with her arms folded. She nodded back at him.
"Yes," she said, "that's Ronnie's camera."
The constables were at the top of the stairs now. Rebus accepted McCall's offer of the supermarket carrier and dropped the camera into it, careful not to mess up any prints. "Todd," he said to the constable he knew, "take this young lady down to Great London Road Station." Tracy's mouth opened. "It's for your own protection," Rebus said. "Go on with them. I'll see you later, soon as I can." She still seemed ready to voice a complaint, but thought better of it, nodded and turned, leaving the room. Rebus listened as she went downstairs, accompanied by the officers. McCall was still searching, though without real concern. Two finds were quite enough to be going on with.
"No smoke without fire," he said. "I had lunch with Tommy today," said Rebus. "My brother Tommy?"
McCall looked up. Rebus nodded.
"Then that's one up to you. He's never taken me to lunch these past 15 years. We were at the Airy."
Now McCall whistled. "To do with Watson's anti-drugs campaign."
"Yes, Tommy's shelling out for it, isn't he? Ach, I shouldn't be hard on him. He's done me a few favors in his time."
"He had a few too many." McCall laughed gently.
"He hasn't changed then. Still, he can afford it. That transport company of his, it runs itself. He used to be there 24 hours a day, 52 weeks of the year. Nowadays, he can take off as long as he likes. His accountant once told him to take a year off. Can you imagine that? For tax purposes. If only we had those kinds of problem, eh, John?"
"You're right there, Tony." Rebus was still holding the supermarket bag. McCall nodded towards it.
"Does this tie it up?"
"It makes things a bit clearer," said Rebus. "I might get it checked for prints."
"I can tell you what you'll find," said McCall. "The deceased's and this guy Charlie's."
"You're forgetting someone."
"Who?"
"You, Tony. You picked the camera up with your fingers, remember?"
"Ah, sorry. I didn't think."
"Never mind.
Anyway, it's something, isn't it? Something to celebrate, I mean. I don't know about you, but I'm starved."
As they left the room, one pillar of books finally gave way, slowing down across the floor like dominoes waiting to be shuffled. Rebus opened the door again to look in.
"Ghosts," said McCall. "That's all. Just ghosts."
We've just heard Hide and Seek by Ian Rankin. Elizabeth George presents Book 18 in her Inspector Linley series, Just One Evil Act, a gripping child in danger story featuring fan favorite Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers. The daughter of Havers' friend Taimula Ashar has been taken by her mother, and Barbara is unable to help. Ashar had never married Angelina, and his name isn't on their daughter's birth certificate. He has no legal claim. Ashar is just beginning to accept his soul-crushing loss when Angelina reappears with shocking news. Their daughter is missing, kidnapped from an Italian marketplace. The Italian police are investigating, and the yard won't get involved until Barbara takes matters into her own hands. Then her partner, Inspector Thomas Linley, is dispatched to Italy as the liaison between the Italian police and the distraught parents. In time, both Barbara and Linley discover the case is far more complex than just a kidnapping. With both her job and the life of a little girl on the line, Barbara must decide what matters most and how far she's willing to go to protect it. Davina Porter narrates.
Linley and Denton had come to depend upon this individual. His name was Steve-O, and what he didn't know about women's flat-track roller derby did not, apparently, bear knowing at all. He was attached to Flaming Aggro, he told them happily. Plus, his sister Sue was a member of the cheering squad. This latter group of individuals had taken up a position whose disturbing proximity to Linley added to the general cacophony surrounding him. They wore black from head to toe, with embellishments of hot pink in the form of tutus, hair decorations, knee socks, shoes, or waistcoats, and they had so far spent most of their time screaming, "Break 'em, baby!" and shaking pink and silver pom-poms. "Great sport, innit?" Steve-O kept saying as the electric magic piled the points onto the scoreboard. "It's that deadly DD Light does most of the scoring. Long as she don't rack up the penalties, we're in, mate." And then onto his feet he leapt, shouting, "Do it, aggro!" as his girlfriend swept by in the midst of the pack. Linley was loath to tell Steve-O that he was a supporter of Boadicea's Broads. It was a matter of chance that he and Denton had placed themselves among the Electric Magic fans. The Boadicea's Broads crowd was on the other side of the taped-off ring, being led into a frenzy of synchronised shouting by their own squad of cheerleaders, who, like those supporting the Electric Magic, were dressed in black, but with touches of red. They appeared to have more experience in the arena of cheerleading. They executed vague dance moves with accompanying leg kicks that were most impressive. It was the sort of event that should have appalled Linley. Had his father been there, doubtless dressed to the nines with one or two touches of ermine and red velvet, lest someone doubt his position in society, he would have lasted less than 5 minutes. The sight of the women on roller skates might have given him a coronary, and listening to Steve-O drop his T's and ignore his H's would have made the poor man's blood run cold. But Linley's father was long in his grave, and Linley himself had spent most of the evening grinning so much that his cheeks were actually beginning to hurt. He'd learned far more than he'd ever have imagined possible upon having made the decision to accept the invitation that had been printed on a handbill he'd found among his post a few days earlier. He'd discovered that they were meant to keep their eyes on the jammer, identified by the star cap that stretched across her helmet. This wasn't a permanent position for a skater, as the star cap was passed round among the women. But the jammer was the team's scoring position, and the ultimate scoring came during a power jam when the opposing team's jammer had to sit in the penalty box. He'd learned the purpose of the pack, and thanks to Steve-O, what it meant when the lead jammer rose from her crouched position to place her hands on her hips. He was still rather vague on the purpose of the pivot, although he knew who she was by the striped cap she wore stretched over her helmet. But he was definitely getting the idea that roller derby was a sport of strategy as well as skill. Mostly, he'd kept his eyes on kick-ass Electra throughout the match-up between London and Bristol. She, he discovered, was quite a jammer. She skated aggressively, like a woman to the roller skates born. Linley wouldn't have thought it possible of the quiet, thoughtful veterinarian he'd met 7 months earlier on the coast of Cornwall. He knew she was practically unbeatable at darts. But this, he never would have guessed it. His pleasure in the wild sport had been interrupted only once, in the middle of a power jam. He'd felt his mobile vibrate in his pocket, and he'd dug it out to see who was ringing him. His first thought was that the Met was calling him back to work, for the caller was his usual partner, Detective Sergeant Barbara Havers. Still, she was ringing from her home phone and not from her mobile, so perhaps, he thought, he was in luck, and nothing had occurred that wanted his attention. He'd answered, but he hadn't been able to hear her. The noise was far too intense. He'd shouted that he would ring her back as soon as he was able to do so, and he'd shoved the mobile back into his pocket and forgotten about the matter. The Electric Magic won the bout 20 minutes later. The two groups of skaters congratulated each other. Athletes mingled with spectators, then cheerleaders mingled with athletes, referees mingled with each other.
That was Just One Evil Act by Elizabeth George. Edgar Award winner Tanya French grabs listeners with her chilling Dublin Murder Squad novels. In Broken Harbor, book 4 in the series, all but one member of the Spain family lies dead, and it's up to Mick Scorcher Kennedy to find out why. Mick must piece together why their house is full of cameras pointed at holes in the walls, and how a nighttime intruder bypassed all the locks. Meanwhile, the town of Broken Harbor holds something else for Mick, disturbing memories of a childhood summer gone terribly wrong. Stephen Hogan narrates.
Richie was open-mouthed and practically hopping off his chair with curiosity. I flipped my comb out of my pocket and gave it a quick run through my hair. Am I good?
Lick arse, Quigley said, through his sulk. I ignored him.
Yeah, Richie said. You're grand. What?
Don't go anywhere, I repeated, and went after O'Kelly. My second hint. He was up behind his desk, with his hands in his trouser pockets, rolling up and down on the balls of his feet. This case had pumped up his adrenaline enough that he wouldn't fit in his chair.
You took your time?
Sorry, sir. He stayed where he was, sucking his teeth and rereading the call sheet on his desk.
How's the Mullen file coming along?
I had spent the last few weeks putting together a file for the Director of Public Prosecutions on one of those tricky drug dealer messes, making sure the little bastard didn't have a single crack to slime through. Some detectives think their job's done the second the charges are filed, but I take it personally when one of my catches wriggles off the hook, which they seldom do.
Good to go, give or take. Could someone else finish it up?
Not a problem. He nodded and kept reading. O'Kelly likes you to ask. It shows you know who's boss. And since he is, in fact, my boss, I have no problem rolling over like a good little doggy when it makes things run more smoothly.
Did something come in, sir? Do you know Bryanstown?
Haven't heard of it.
Neither had I. It's one of those new places up the coast past Balbriggan. Used to be called Broken Bay something.
Broken Harbour, I said.
Yeah, I know Broken Harbour. It's Bryanstown now, and by tonight the whole country will have heard of it.
I said, this is a bad one.
O'Kelly laid one heavy palm on the call sheet, like he was holding it down. He said, husband, wife, and two kids stabbed in their own home. The wife's headed for hospital. It's touch and go. The rest are dead.
We left that for a moment, listening to the small tremors it sent through the air. I said, how did it come in?
The wife's sister. They talk every morning, but today she couldn't get through. That got her het up enough that she got in her car and headed out to Bryanstown. Car's in the driveway. Lights are on in broad daylight. No one's answering the door. She rings the uniforms. They break the door down, and surprise, surprise.
Who's unseen?
Just the uniforms. They took one look and figured they were out of their depth. Called it straight in.
Beautiful, I said. There are plenty of morons out there who would have spent hours playing detective and churning the whole case to shit before they admitted defeat and called in the real thing. It looked like we had lucked into a pair with functioning brains.
I want you on this. Can you take it?
I'd be honored.
If you can't drop everything else, tell me now and I'll put Flaherty on this one. This takes priority.
Flaherty is the guy with the slam dunks and the top solve rate. I said, that won't be necessary, sir. I can take it.
Good,
O'Kelly said. But he didn't hand over the call sheet. He tilted it to the light, inspecting it and rubbing a thumb along his jawline.
Curran, he said. Is he able for this?
Young Richie had been on the squad all of 2 weeks. A lot of the lads don't like training in the new boys, so I do it. If you know your job, you have a responsibility to pass the knowledge on.
He will be, I said. I can stick him somewhere else for a while, give you someone who knows what he's at.
If Curran can't take the heat, we might as well find out now. I didn't want someone who knew what he was at. The bonus of newbie wrangling is that it saves you a load of hassle. All of us who've been around a while have our own ways of doing things and too many cooks, etc. A rookie, if you know how to handle them, slows you down a lot less than another old hand. I couldn't afford to waste time playing after you, no after you. Not on this one.
We've just heard a sampling of Broken Harbor by Tanya French. Readers, we're closing this week's case on murder and mayhem. Justice has been served in a great new selection of titles. For more ideas, and not the usual suspects, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.